Okay.
I don't know why it doesn't work.
Is there anybody else who came in who need their project back? Just make sure that you take it at the end. There are a couple of things to discuss before we start the class. The plan currently is to return the homework to on next Monday. Okay. I plan to put up the solutions tonight. By tonight, I would just connect them up. So you would have the solutions for the homework, and then the graded ones will be returned next Monday. We could have the exam, midterm exam would be in class, and we could have it either next Wednesday or the Monday afterwards. Is there any preference? What? People want Wednesday. What? 17th is the Monday after that. 12th is Wednesday. Okay, how many people want it on Wednesday? Okay, how many on Monday? I was worried for a while that we have changed the world. I mean, you are in the wrong world. I mean, all my life I remember we would prepare for the exam and then we'll go to the exam and the exam would be canceled and we are so happy. You know, it's just, it's like, you know, it's part of being a student is to try and postpone things as much as you can. So, okay, so we'll have it on Monday. And so you'll have enough time to look at your homeworks and also ask me questions and so on. So that would be in class. Okay. What I would do is actually I will give as part of the solutions for homework 2, I'll actually, some of the homework 2 problems were from a previous midterm. So I will just give you the entire midterm with the solutions. Okay, so that'll also give you an idea of how the midterm would be. You know, at least it's one of the ones that I have run before. Normally, it requires you to think on your feet very fast. So don't expect to start. If it's an in-class exam, you should know everything by then. Okay, so it would be long and it would basically test both what you understand as well as how fast you are. Yes, sir. Yes, everything, open everything. Probably not open Google, but I mean, in general, what I say to people is, if you're busy opening the notes, then you probably are running out of the clock anyway. But, you know, it's open. Okay? Any other questions? Okay. So, if there are no questions, then what I'm planning to do today is continue the discussion on text classification using naive Bayes as one of the main approaches. Yes, sir. What's the scale? Okay, I'm sorry. He actually gave me the numbers. I believe 40 is the highest. Okay, it's on the scale of 0 to 40, right? 0 to 40, and 40 was the highest, I think 10 was the lowest. Okay, I will send you the exact statistics. I mean, he did give it to me, I just forgot to write it down. What? How was it graded? I think he provided some information, but, you know, if not, we can make sure that. What? So 10, 15, 15. So 15 for write up, 15 for coding. 10 for output. That's a reasonable thing in the, I think. You need to, it's not enough that the code is working, especially in this particular thing where actually there's very little code to write. So analysis is important. I do want to mention that eventually I would hope that project zero, I mean this is project part A, would wind up having much lower weight compared to part two and part three. This is to get you started off, okay. But we did grade it and it's graded out of a scale of 40. I fully expect that people who didn't do that well here might wind up doing great job by the end, and vice versa. You know, people who already got 40, they decide, oh, that's enough. So we decide not to do anything. But clearly, I think the part two and part three are much more about what you need to learn in terms of, you know, actually running one of these techniques and, you know, and analyzing the performance. Okay? Any other questions? Okay. So, so we were talking about naive Bayes classification, and are there any questions on how these numbers are being computed? Given, you know, basically, in this particular case, you are computing what is the probability that that Russell would weight, given that one of the attributes patterns is equal to full, okay, and you just use the Bayes rule and you use the independence assumption. And for each of these numbers, so for example, patterns equal to full given will weight equal to yes, these can be read off from the data. That's the easy part. Read off means you these are basically counting. Okay, so you for this, the denominator would be the total number of cases where will weight equal to yes. And the numerator would be the total number of those cases, the ones where will weight equal to yes, where patterns also equals to be full. That's all. Okay, yeah. Attributes, no, we are making the assumption that the attributes are independent.
But there is a situation
that they are not. Yeah. So basically, the in those cases, naive Bayes-based text classification won't work well. Okay. If you have non-independence, then basically what you need to do is, suppose I wind up knowing that to the extent attributes are dependent at all, they're only dependent in pairs. Okay, then that basically would mean that instead of having n probabilities, I will need n square probabilities to be computed. Ultimately, the number of, okay, so for naive Bayes, for every learning method, there are basically, you're looking to fit a hypothesis to a set of examples. A hypothesis is a function which takes an example and says yes or no. And this function needs some parameters, okay? If you're trying to fit a line separating pluses from minuses, then the parameters for the line would be y equal to mx plus c. So m and c would be the parameters. Okay. If you are trying to fit naive Bayes classifier, then the parameters would be all these numbers. Patterns equal to full given will weight equal to yes, and will weight equal to yes. These are the numbers. There are n times d times k such numbers where n is the number of classes, D is the number of values for each attribute, okay, and what is the K? Oh, I forget. Number of attributes, okay. So those many parameters. So if you play with those numbers, an NBC is completely given by those set of numbers. And if you change those numbers, you have a different classifier. Just as a line is given by MX plus C, if you change M or C, you get a different line. Okay, learning the parameters is learning those numbers. Now learning, you might say, is too big a word for what we are doing, which is counting. But learning is also a big word to say to what we did in the k-nearest neighbor algorithm, where all you did was compared the new guy to the old guys and found who are the closest new guys. Okay, so these parameters are what you are estimating. And once you estimate these parameters, you keep them. So for the profile of the user, in a sense, let me see. So a profile of the user, the learning, the hypothesis is completely characterized by these numbers. For each class, prior probability of the class, for each attribute and its value and class, the probability that that attribute takes that value given that the example is from that class. These are the only numbers you need. You compute these, keep it somewhere, and when any new example comes, using Bayes' rule in essence, when a new example comes, using Bayes' rule in essence, you're splitting any question you're asked in terms of the numbers you have. Okay, the only number we don't care about is the prior probability of the example itself. Okay, and that's because if you're comparing multiple classes, then this becomes a normalization factor. Okay, you can think of this as alpha times a number, and if I give you the entire distribution in terms of alphas, then you know that all those numbers have to add up to 1. So alpha, 0.3 alpha plus 0.4 alpha plus 0.7 alpha should add up to 1. So you know what alpha is, because it's a distribution, it's a probability distribution. Okay, so these numbers we don't care about, and these you already stored as part of learning. That's NBC. Okay. There were bunches of questions on biases. I sent mails on explaining those. Are there any further things? This is, in a sense, to me, a digression. This is very important stuff, but it's general for machine learning in general rather than for this particular class. If there are questions, I could go through it. If not, we will continue with the NBC stuff. Okay. Okay. So one thing, now we figured out what naive Bayes classifier does. All we're going to do now is to make sure that it works well in practice, and it works well for text in practice. Those are the two things. And one first problem to notice is naive Bayes classifier winds up multiplying, okay, so the first thing is the estimation of parameters, okay? So you're trying to compute these kinds of numbers. In fact, this could be multiple attributes and their values given a class. This would be the class given multiple attributes and their values, because this is the example and this is the class. Okay. Now, the more of those there are, the more of these numbers you would be actually using, which have already been estimated. The question is, how likely is that this estimate, which is being computed in terms of frequencies, is actually correct with respect to the actual data? So think of the simplest issue, which is if you are trying to compute the probability that a coin comes heads. If I did two experiments, and it just so happened that it came heads both the times, then I would have said that the probability estimate is 2/2. Worse yet, the probability estimate for my two experiments for tails is 0. Okay, there are two issues going on here. One, of course, is the smaller the data, the worse off your probability estimates are. This is not surprising. The second is, I don't really care as much about the fact that I could be worse off, but I'm particularly worried about the fact that I will start having some zeros. Why? Suppose of the many probabilities that you are keeping here, of the many n times d times k probabilities of this type that you're keeping here, if a few of them wind up being zero, and you would be multiplying those numbers out in doing the actual classification. So you'll get zero times lots and lots of other things, which will be zero too. Okay, so A, there is a problem with the estimate, and B, it's particularly problematic when there are zeros. Okay, so what you try to do in general, it's nothing to do with a naive Bayes classifier. In general, when you're trying to compute these kinds of probabilities, is you try to smooth your estimate from the experiments with some prior knowledge you might have had. Okay, and that is basically what's called Laplacian smoothing, or M estimates. And that's done all the time. So suppose I'm trying to compute this probability that attribute AI has value VJ given that class is CI. That would require this number in red, number of instances where class is CI and attribute is VI, attribute AI has value VI, divided by the number of instances where class is CI. Okay, now these could be, these numbers, this number in particular could be very small. So what we might do in essence is, let me just first of all show you the syntactic idea. The syntactic idea is add to the top a number and add to the bottom another number so that it will never be zero by something. You know, syntactically speaking, it will never become zero anymore. Okay. Now what we did here is m times p by m, where p is the prior probability. Okay. So one way of making sense of what I just did there is think of p to be the prior probability that AI will ever have value VJ, whether it is from class CI or not. Okay? That's your bias about, that's your understanding about when AI takes value VJ. Is it, if AI has 15 possible values, do you think it takes each of those values uniformly? Do you think it takes some of those values more often than others? That would be part of your understanding of how the attribute takes those values. Okay? So if you happen to know that information, then in essence what we did was you not only chose some number of examples from the actual training examples, but you also basically chose m examples from a distribution that is equal to the prior distribution of AI equal to VJ. Okay, so that's what we are saying. So it's like you are, apart from the normal samples, you're also getting virtual samples, m more virtual samples drawn according to the prior probability on how AI takes different values. Now, if you do this, this obviously sort of makes sense, because if you don't know how many times in class I AI winds up taking VJ, if you don't have that information, at least use the information about how often does AI take this value to begin with. It's a sort of a smoothing. Okay, the bigger in you doing this, if the bigger M is, the more your numbers would be actually reflecting the prior distribution rather than the training samples. The smaller M is, the more it's going to be connected to the training samples. So this is sort of a smoothing parameter. It makes the probabilities be not completely dependent on the few training examples you have. Okay? Now, basically, you could, this is called just M estimate, and you can set any number, any value M, and this is like the fudge parameter. To, if you think that your data is representative enough, you keep M to be very small. You know, if you think the data is a very small sample, then you keep M to be higher. Okay. One particular example that people try, one particular valuation that people try is think of M to be the, so for example, AI, the attribute AI can take N values. N values, let's say. Okay. Then I can say the prior probability is 1 over N if I assume that the attribute takes all the values uniformly. Now, if I set m equal to n, then it would be m times, n times 1 over n, so that would be 1, and this would be n. Okay? In fact, that version of m estimates, where m is set to be equal to the number of values the attribute actually can take, and p is set to be uniform probability distribution, that's actually called Laplacian smoothing. Okay? But it's just a special case where you are setting M such that it sort of looks syntactically nice. You know, it looks like, so it does make sense. I mean, you know, this prior probability, if you don't know anything else, you may as well assume uniform distribution. So you're taking 1 over N values, and M you are taking to be N, and so that, just so that they cancel out. That's all. Okay, so oftentimes what you'll wind up doing is you add 1 to here and you add the number of domain values here. That would be one estimate. But there's nothing sacrosanct about it. It's basically a smoothing parameter. And a syntactic reason why you need to do this is you're going to be in trouble otherwise, because you could get a bunch of zeros. also. Okay, one other thing is, even with this, actually, you should realize that you're doing huge number of probabilities being multiplied with each other. They're all small numbers, and so you can get underflow errors. Okay, so the right thing to do is do it in log space. Take logarithms, add them up, rather than do multiplication. Because multiplication, you have this underflow problem. Okay, so that's again one of these practical things. And since log is a monotonically connected function of probabilities, you can maximize with respect to that too. Okay. Now, text. So this is Russell. Until now, we talked about Russell's restaurant scenario. I want to now think of what happens if I actually have text documents. Okay. What are the attributes and what are their values? Okay. So here is a nice way of going through our model, actually. Let me just go through it from the most general way of looking at it and make a bunch of assumptions until it becomes easy to handle. Okay, so basically the question is, your model depends on how do you think the documents are generated. So here is my first assumption, a reasonable one. Assume that the words from a fixed vocabulary V appear in the document D at different positions. Let's assume the document D has L words. Okay, so at each position, you go into your vocabulary bag, pick a vocabulary item, put it in with replacement. You look at it and write that down. And then for the second position, you again do that. Okay, this is a way you could generate documents. Okay, now, so this assumes, so then probability that the document is, probability of the document given the class C would be probability that the, because the document is made up of all the words, P1, position 1 to position L, because document has length L, okay? So the probability that you can get this document given class C is the same as probability that you can get P1 equal to W1 and P2 equal to W2, et cetera, PL equal to WL given class C, okay? I'm looking at this because these are the numbers that you have on the right-hand side of the equation in the NBC, right? Because you are always asking this question, what is the probability that the document belongs to class C? Probability C given D is what you're computing, and on the right-hand side, you use probability D given C numbers, okay? Now, the D given C is this, and this is a humongous conjunctive probability. So, I could assume that word appearance probabilities are independent of each other, which is the obvious naive Bayes assumption. That would basically get me to this whole commas become big multiplication. That's all. So now, probability that position 1 equal to W1 given C times probability that position 2 equal to W2 given C times probability that position L equal to WL given C. Okay? Still, the problem here is each position has a sort of a different distribution. Somehow, the first position, you have a different distribution with which you are picking the words than the second position, than the third position. So I'll go ahead and make one more assumption, which is that assume that word occurrence probability is independent of its position in the document, which makes sort of sense. You know, the way actually I told you, which is I have a bunch of positions here, 1 to L, and I have a bag of words. I pick one word, look at it, write it down. Pick another word, look at it, and write it down. If I'm doing that, I'm using the same exact distribution for each of the positions. I know that if I make a document like that, you can't read it, but, you know, that was there to begin with. Okay, so what I'm doing now is essentially probability that P1 equal to W1 given C is the same as probability that P2 equal to W1 given C is the same as probability that PL equal to W1 given C. So essentially, the same distribution is being used to pick the words. So if you are more of a article-oriented guy, you're more likely to pick articles and put in than other words. And if you are a much more of a large word-oriented person, then you're likely to pick large words and put them into the document than the small words. But you're using the same distribution irrespective of the position in the document. Okay. Now, if I make these assumptions, then I know what the numbers that I'm trying to compute are. For each word, basically I'm computing probability of the occurrence of the word given class. And those are the numbers I need to compute using the NBC document. Okay. Let me show you the actual algorithm. The last line there is repeated here. So here's the way you could actually do NBC on the text data. Let's suppose we use the vocabulary of words in document, in all the documents D. Then for each category CI, remember it's been a while, but remember that this is classification learning. So somebody already gave you training data and told you how many classes are there and what are the labels for the training data. Okay, so for each category I, you essentially, for each category I, you do the following thing. So for the prior probability of the category I is nothing but the number of documents in that category in the training data divided by the total number of documents. Okay, and then the other one is your probability of word I given class I. Probability of word I given class I. Okay, that's the distribution that word I would occur in a particular class document. And the way you would do that is take the total, first forget about these numbers. Take the total number of times, if you have the super document, which is the concatenation of all the documents, take the number of times this word WI occurred in all the documents. That is a baseline, that's NI. And take the number of times it occurs in the class I documents, which is NIJ. So what you really want is NIJ by NI. You have those numbers, you can compute those. Now what is this stuff, plus 1 and plus V? That's the M estimate. Each attribute, each word position can take how many values? V values. And I'll assume that it takes each of those V values with uniform probability. Suppose I assume that. Then, you know, V times 1 by V, which is 1 here and V here. That's what you do. Okay? So this is basically naive-Bayes classification. Just to put this in perspective, and so when given, I mean, this is obvious, given a new document X, let N be the number of word occurrences in X, and in essence, you would compute the class probability that this document will belong to each of those classes, and take the max, okay? And then say that's the class that you belong to. Notice, however, that the best way to think of NBC is as computing the posterior probability distribution of the class variable given the example. So it actually gives the entire distribution. What's the probability that it's class 1? What's the probability of class 2? What's the probability of class 3? And if you are into just picking one answer, you take the maximum of them. But you can also use this notion of, you know, soft membership and say, well, it really belongs, you know, 60% to this class, 40% to this class. And sometimes, you know, that might be a reasonable thing to say. If in fact there are 10,000 classes, I mean, there are like 100 classes, and this thing belongs 0.5 to class 1, 0.5 to class 7, and 0 to everybody else, then it's worth telling that to the user. I mean, maybe 0.500001 and 0.499999. You know, rather than just take the max and say this is the class, you might want to actually realize that it almost equally belongs to these two classes out of 100 classes. Okay. What else do you want to do? One interesting thing is this sort of an algorithm and variations of this have been applied, let's say, to Usenet articles from 20 different groups. Okay, lots and lots of people have used text classification based on NBC and variations of it. This is a reasonably no-frills study, which actually is reported in Mitchell's textbook, where they tried to just apply this unigram model directly, okay, nothing changed, to decide, given an article which is taken from one of 20 different news groups, try to guess which news group was it taken from, or try to predict, you know, guess basically is tossing, okay. So obviously upfront they had some amount of data for which they have given the labels, and they used that to train the NBC parameters NBC parameters essentially means the class probabilities and the word given class probabilities. Those are the ones. And all of which you just count. These are counting arguments. Okay. What's interesting is they had at that time from the 20 different news groups, they got as high as 89% accuracy in prediction. So given an article, they could predict with 89% accuracy which group it actually came from. This is humongous because if you were to toss a 20-sided coin, the probability that you would be right would be 5%. So that's, you know, it's actually, by the way, that's very important. In the beginning of machine learning research, empirical evaluations were not very big. Okay? So much so that there were algorithms, very complicated algorithms that would be written out, which when people came around to actually testing them on real data, they found that they are worse than 0.5 accuracy, 50% accuracy, which means negative of whatever that learning algorithm does is better than deciding its prediction. Okay, so there was a lot of negative research that was going on in a sense, and it's good to know what the accuracies are. I mean, so in fact, anything which does better than 5% is doing something in this scenario. And if it's a two-class categorization, anything which does better than 50% is doing something. Okay. In fact, it's very interesting to know that there are meta-algorithms out there, such as boosting, which, given any learning algorithm, and to be called a learning algorithm, you better be more than uniform probability. That is, if it's a two-class classification, you should be 50.0000001% correct. Okay. If that is the case, then asymptotically you can bootstrap this learning algorithm on itself and reach any level of accuracy you want. Okay. As far as learning is concerned, the worst number is 50% for a Boolean classification, 50%. Less than 50 is actually good, because then just do the opposite of whatever your learner is doing. Let me say. You see what I'm saying? I mean, this is like, reminds me of this joke that which clock is better, the clock which is like randomly off the time, you know, by about 1 hour, but you don't know exactly how much off, or a clock which has stopped. The clock which has stopped is correct at least twice in a day, okay, whereas the other one is never correct. Okay, so that's the kind of argument we are making. You know, if you are so wrong that sometimes you can actually take negative of you and you will become right. And, you know, in learning, anything below 50 is good too, and in anything above 50 is great too. 50 is the bad thing for Boolean classification. Okay. Okay. One thing that everybody does is, should we use all the words? In fact, I'm pretty sure that even that 89% accuracy thing did not use all the words, because all the words, even in news group articles written by people with pretty poor vocabulary, would still be large if you take the concatenation of all the words. Okay, there are way too many words. So one idea is to just reduce the number of words that you consider. So this is essentially like saying not all words are created equal. I would only take a subset of words that are occurring anywhere in the document, and then those are the ones that are considered features. Everything else is not considered feature, which is fine. Nothing that we said till now changes if you just pick a subset of the vocabulary, and the rest is all gobbledygook. Okay, and only these words are considered vocabulary words. So the question then is, what are the right words to pick? Okay, and this basically the idea of feature selection. So if you can pick some of the features, in the originally the document was described in terms of all the words, which are all the features, and if you can take a subset and then train on those and use those to train, that basically you're selecting. So in doing so, what you're actually doing is a lot of things at the same time. One, of course, is reducing the dimensionality of the data. If the vocabulary is 1500 words, then each of the documents is a 1500 dimensional point. And there are lots and lots of problems with high dimensional data. Okay, reducing it to 500 is good. And in fact, vocabulary is never 1500, it's more like 25,000, you know, for any reasonable kinds of things. Okay, so I might just want to take 500, and that would really cut down. So I'm looking at classification in a 500 dimensional space rather than in a 25,000 dimensional space. The second thing is, of course, that it makes my life easier, especially something like NBC. For something like NBC, the number of parameters I would need would reduce, right? The number of parameters I would need would be reduced because I'm only looking for the word given class only for 500 words now instead of 25,000 words. Okay? So that reduces the number. And it actually winds up improving the accuracy of learners quite a bit because you would wind up, for example, you could remove potentially useless features. You know, there was a comment I made last class that what if you wind up in the Russell example, what if you have bunches and bunches of irrelevant features such as the color of his shirt and all that stuff, and two examples, and you have a test example which winds up agreeing with a whole bunch of irrelevant attributes, which you and I know as irrelevant attributes, with example one, but agrees with a whole bunch of much fewer number of relevant values in example two, whose label should it take? Okay? And if you don't pick the right set of, if you basically keep all those irrelevant attributes, then obviously it'll take the label of the first guy. Okay? So you want to avoid that problem and reduce the number of irrelevant attributes. And there are many approaches for feature selection. And in fact, feature selection is sort of like and very connected to dimensionality detection, as we discussed in latent semantic indexing sorts of stuff. One big difference compared to latent semantic indexing and what I'm thinking of right now, which is take a subset of features, is in LSI you are considering linear combinations of existing features as the new features. In feature selection, you're only considering subsets. So each feature either gets to be taken in or not taken in. You don't get to say, well, can you take 0.2 of me and 0.3 of my brother? Both of us would like to be in the new feature space. LSI will allow you. Remember, size plus length was allowed for the fishies. But feature selection, you're picking individual features. Okay. Now, the specific algorithm that you actually can use is, there are lots and lots of approaches. A simple one that everybody uses, if they have no better idea, is to just do what's called mutual information. Okay, so how informative is it for you to know? So normally what they do is they compute the mutual information of an attribute equal to a value given the class. So basically, in the case of text, they compute the mutual information between a word and a class. Okay? Now, if the class and word are independent, that means telling you that the class occurred doesn't tell you anything about the word occurrence. Then there's no point in keeping that word around. Okay? If telling you that the word occurred tells you something about the class occurring, then you would like to keep that word. Now, the way probabilities capture, in probability theory, the way you capture dependencies between pair of variables is the way their intersection is defined. Probability A and B is probability of A times probability of B only in the case where A and B are independent. Okay? So what you could do is you could estimate the probability of A, that is the probability of the word itself in the entire document corpus, probability of the class itself in the entire corpus, and also estimate the probability of the word and class together in the entire corpus, and see how the product corresponds, compares with the estimate of A and B. If they're equal, that means this word is useless as far as this class is concerned. So if you take the ratio probability of A and probability of B, and probability of A multiplied by probability of B divided by probability of A and B, that would be one exactly when A and B are independent. And so you take a log of that, you would get a zero. Okay? So you nicely describe mutual information of A and B to be the probability of A and B times log of probability of A and B by probability of A and probability of B. And for text, A would be word, B would be class. So this is probability that the word and class occur together in the in your training examples. And these numbers you can use estimates. So the probability that the word and class occur together times log of probability that they occur together divided by each of one of them occurs, other of them occurs. These are not conditionals. These are direct probabilities. Okay? And that's all. And you use, so you compute that number for every word class combination. Okay? And then basically what you could do is you could sort them in the order of highest to lowest mutual information and take the top 500 if you want 500 best. That's the way to do it. It's very cheap, very, very cheap. And it captures this little intuition that if, you know, word and if the word is independent of the class, then the joint would be the same as multiplication of the marginal. Okay? Now, and you can actually look at some of the obvious cases. So when, in fact, if A and B are truly independent, then this would be log of 1, and that would be, the whole thing will become 0. And if A and B are fully correlated, if A and B are fully correlated, that means A is the same as B. Okay, then what happens? That would just be log of probability of A, because probability of A times probability of A divided by, so the top would be probability of A and probability of B divided by probability of A and B. Okay, so the numerator would be probability of A times probability of A divided by probability of A and A is the same as probability of A. So one probability of A gets cancelled, so other remains. Okay, and so now you wind up having probability of A, log probability of A, and you can show that that's basically the information content of that single feature itself. This is actually the way you classically define information in the information theory. Okay, and this will wind up being highest where. For what probability of A does this become maximum? A is a random event. When would you really like to pay big bucks to me? 50-50. If A is a random event which never occurs, you don't need me to tell you that it won't occur tomorrow. Okay? If A is a random event which almost always occurs, you don't need me to tell you that it's going to occur tomorrow. It's exactly when A can occur with 50% probability and not occur with 50% probability, 0.5, 0.5, that's when you're dying to know, right? So that's the information content, okay? So anyway, so this is the way mutual information is used to pick the set of attributes. And in fact, here is an example where this was a different example. This paper is available. It's a Shahami and Co., Shahami and somebody else paper for the spam filtering. This is one of the earliest spam filtering applications using Bayesian learning. And so they had 1578 training data. The training data was 1789 hand-tagged email messages. The messages were tagged spam and non-spam. And apparently the top was junk and the 211 was the legitimate, that is non-junk. And using this, you're supposed to learn. And what they did in their particular case is they actually took the union of all the vocabulary in all those messages, but just took the top 500 using the mutual information content. Okay? And they show that if you do only top 500 and do naive Bayes versus if you take all the words and do naive Bayes, your classification accuracy on the test data improves with the smaller one, which is good because the smaller one was where the computer was happier because it had to multiply much fewer numbers, right? Okay. Of course, So this is actually a nice thing. What they did is they essentially did a precision recall curve to decide the effectiveness of the spam filtering approach. Okay, so what is the precision for spam filtering approach? If you say something is spam, it better be spam. That is precision. What's recall for spam filtering approach? If you say something is not spam and it is actually spam, then you lost recall. Okay? So precision recall curves will come all over the place. So you can have spam filters which will only be picking Nigerian millionaire males. So they are highly precise. The ones that they say is spam is actually spam, unless you are one of those people who still think there is $1 million that people in Nigeria are trying to give you. Okay? But it's not particularly useful because the all other, you know, stuff, there's lots and lots of other kinds of spam is still getting through. So recall is low, precision is high. And what we need normally is curves which are high precision and high recall. So what they do to show that some approach works better than other approach is plot the precision and recall curve using your nice, you know, normally the 11-point curve, but in this case they started at 86 up to 1. Recall, and then the ones which are higher are better method. Agreed? So it's no different between text search versus spam filtering. Now evaluation is the same still. Okay. So one interesting thing, of course, is actually here they did not show what happened. In this picture, they don't show what happens if they consider all the words versus just consider 500 most informative words. When they say words only in this picture, that is the 500 most informative words. That's too easy for them. That's where they start. And then what they do on top of that is they actually, to improve their efficiency, they wound up also considering suggestive phrases. Okay, because you can always say, I will also consider phrases, but that increases the vocabulary size humongously. There are many more phrases in your document than there are words, depending on what sized phrases you're looking for, what possible size phrases you're looking for. Okay? So what they did was they went ahead and looked for things like free money, must be over 21. Notice that this is so green behind the ears. This was done in 1998 when they didn't know that you can have free dot, 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 slash, divided by money. Right? If that's how you get, you know, if you are getting free money still, the way you're getting it is they no longer write free space money. They'll say free and then put all sorts of extra punctuation and money. Okay. And so you still have to get rid of the punctuation. But those days, people were nicer in 98. And so they would just write these kind of names. Free money, must be over 21. I mean, whoever says must be over 21 anymore? I mean, that cuts down their customer list too much. Anyway, so they use these as extra features. So that actually goes back to a question I think you asked last time. You know, so you notice how we are nicely going from let the text document describe itself, all the words in the document are its features, to, well, of them pick the right ones, but still domain independent because the way you are picking the right ones is just using the training data. To now I'm saying I will also consider certain features that are actually important for this domain. Now who says this? The guy who wrote this. You know, that's you and me. We know that certain types of spam mails have certain types of phrases, and so looking for them is useful. So they threw a couple of those in, that's hand-coded features. So in addition to all the words, you also have these phrases. And for each of these phrases, you also compute the probability that the phrase is there given the class is this. So once you call it a feature, the feature could be a single word, it could be a multi-word phrase. The way base classifier treats them is one and the same. It doesn't care whether the probabilities are of those of words, or those of phrases, or in particular, those of, you know, is there peculiar punctuation? If there is peculiar punctuation in the entire document, in the mail, then they will say, has peculiar punctuation as a feature. That too would be have a number computed. And then, furthermore, they're now saying they also consider domains. Those were the days where enough, not too much spoofing was going on. So, you know, you can assume that .com and .edu are legit. Whereas, you know, .net and .za, you know, those are guys we don't like. Okay, so they basically could use these as the features, predictive features. Okay. Now this actually brings up several points. Point one is these are domain dependent features. Your domain knowledge about what makes something spam versus not spam is being thrown into the spam detection software. Now that looks as if it is cheating. It looks as if you are giving more information than is present in the training examples. But we get by in life by cheating, if cheating is to use our background knowledge. Why? What's the advantage of me trying to relearn something that I already know? Okay, and what's the advantage of me trying to let my kid figure out that putting his hand on hot stove is actually a bad thing? I mean, he can learn it by himself. You know, I learned it once, and why shouldn't he learn it? We stop it because, you know, I know it, and, you know, you can stop. And I'm sure he'll become 14 or 15 and he'll say, you know, all of your learning is wrong and I have to relearn. That's a different story. But we actually use the background knowledge to influence learning. And, you know, in several of the slides that I talked about bias, I mentioned this curious ambivalence in the machine learning community about whether or not you should be using domain knowledge. Because in essence, what is currently called machine learning community is made up of statisticians and AI folks. And AI folks never had any problem about background knowledge. Statistics, on the other hand, assumes that priors are bad things to consider. You know, you're not supposed to put any biases. You know, you should let the data describe itself. It's a sort of, you know, I mean, there is no place where this is written, but this is essentially what happened. And so much so that prior to the marriage between AI and statistics-oriented machine learning, most of the algorithms in machine learning would talk openly about using declarative domain knowledge as part of machine learning. After the marriage, which has been a good marriage, I'm not trying to, you know, say bad things about statisticians, now people feel really, really, really kind of apologetic that they're using domain knowledge. And in fact, the current way you use domain knowledge is the sort of awkward way, such as, remember, in the case of clustering, you might say certain things cannot occur together, certain things can occur together. Okay? And in the case of here, somebody actually picked these features, and I'm sure he probably had enough trouble getting into machine learning conference. Okay? And furthermore, in fact, the semi-learning, the whole area of semi-supervised learning is a big thing now in machine learning. And it's sort of crazy, you know, for people who have been alive before statistics and machine learning married, because background knowledge was always part of learning. In fact, there are statements, you know, great quotes saying that you don't learn anything that you don't almost already know. This is why you're made to take 1,500 classes before you took my class. Why can't I just go to grade school and teach my son all this stuff? Apart from the fact that he can't stand me, you know, why don't I do that? Why can't I just keep teaching it 15 times until he gets it? You know, you get yourself, your knowledge, background knowledge level increased before you start learning furthermore. Okay. And currently, actually, using domain knowledge in machine learning is done in sort of these reluctant and indirect ways. You know, this whole area of kernel-based learning is where you essentially, whatever you know has to be written in the form of a kernel, which has some nice mathematical properties, and then only it can be used. And it reminds me of this great quote by Woody Allen that, which I might paraphrase and I'll send you later, is that everything must be converted into first order predicate calculus before being eaten. Okay, so it's essentially, you're doing it almost as if it must be done that way, as against finding algorithms which can use declarative domain knowledge. So that's my opinion, but I think in this case, actually, this guy does use the domain knowledge, and furthermore, not surprisingly, when he uses the domain knowledge, he does better. Now, should he be thrown out of machine learning? Well, what do you think spam filtering algorithms currently do? That's the current state of art in spam filters. If people are trying to sell you spam filters for $10, $20, $30, first try to download Spam Assassin and use it. Okay? Spam Assassin is a open source spam filtering algorithm, spam filtering system. It's unabashedly domain oriented. It's all about writing features, you know, the kinds of features that they write are things like this. Okay, that's a message caught by SAM assassin on 2004, and it looked for these kinds of features. It has a forged MUA Outlook, it has a forged Outlook tag, it has 30%, 40% HTML, it has HTML fonts big, it has HTML no mime, and it has been received in SARBS, which is a place where SAM mail, if it has been received and been tagged, people will remember that this particular message, this particular source, or this particular message sender or suspect. Hugely domain specific. Okay, and now of course SAM assassin has a Bayesian learner, which is basically doing NBC classification, and most people don't use it. In fact, I've been trying my best to make Google mailer realize that I hate small cap investment opportunities. Okay, Google is extremely good. I mean, those of you who have Gmail know that they're pretty darn good in catching spam. But apparently, they have this problem with small cap versus large cap investment. They think that's important for me. And I have talked to a bunch of other people. They also keep getting it. And my own conspiracy theory is they want us to, they are worried that, you know, somewhere along the line, some important information about Google stock price would be spammed. And so they're just letting it go through. Okay. So I am actually making my darn thing learn by clicking, saying spam, spam, spam. I've been doing this and I'm giving up now. You know, anyway. So that's the state of the art in spam mail filtering, which is a combination of domain-specific, hugely domain-specific upfront, plus learner afterwards. Okay, and anybody who starts by saying actually just learn from scratch, they just don't make it, because you know you basically there's just enough known knowledge. Why should every one of you independently figure out that the Nigerian dead millionaire is spam mail? What's the advantage of it? Okay, and so this is my current quote, is the variation of Santayana's quote, which I wrote somewhere, that those who ignore background domain knowledge are forced to relearn it, rediscover it. And it's, learning is not fun. I mean, you should do it only if it's needed. Okay, I'm telling you this. You really should use your knowledge. Okay. One of the other interesting things that SAM assassin does is collaborative. What it does is basically they realize that mail is unlike real mail, such as you got Nobel Prize, which are very specific. You know, most of us here probably are not getting those mails. Things such as you may already have won $10,000, they are not particularly specific to you. They get sent to millions of people. And so what you do is you there is this bunch of approaches, such as Whipple's Razor is one, where you compute the checksum of this message. I mean, once the first guy says this is spam, this information is sent to a central database, where the checksum of this message is kept, and saying that this is spam. And so now what SAM assassin does is, apart from all the other features, it also calls Whipple's Razor and says, do you think this is spam? Did anybody say this is spam? And once again, the way SAM assassin works is actually very similar to the way Naive Bayes works. It is adding numbers from multiple sources. No one of these features has the entire sway. What they do is they give it each of these some small weights. This is a very simplistic scenario where they give handcrafted weights to this. And they add them all the weights and see if they have crossed the threshold. And you might be thinking, what's the whole point of machine learning literature? Why are these people doing it by hand? And I'm saying, it's not surprising at all. Because unlike some completely unknown domain where there's no background knowledge, spam, we know a lot about spam. The very fact that I can make jokes about spam and you can understand means we know a lot about spam. And why should you make your learner not use it? You know, what advantage do you have by doing that? Okay. Spam is so big now that Spam has its own conference, and I am not sure they didn't have the second version. 2004 had the first international Spam conference. This year they don't think they had it. Probably they got too many Spam papers or something, but you know, as far as I know, they didn't have a second one. It's a big, big deal, and everybody and their brother are coming up with approaches for handling spam mailing issues. You can read this. This is like, you know, something about the whole arms race notion of spam. And in fact, it's very interesting how as soon as there is commercial advantage for doing spam, you know, all sorts of putting, you know, it's not enough to just say, you have to think well about how to stop spam. And the most obvious ways of stopping spam that have been tried have all been very bad. In fact, some of the classic examples, I believe, I don't know whether I wrote it here, there was a mail that AT&T sent to its customers who had in, you know, accounts on the now defunct AT&T mailing accounts, I guess, about spam, and many of their own mails were detected as spam by their spam mailers. Okay. 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 This one, I think I mentioned it last time. Basically, NBC will wind up giving pretty ugly estimates for the probabilities because, you know, features are not really independent. Okay, and yet it winds up doing quite well in practice, much better than what anybody expects. And there's a nice paper by Domingos and Pazani in 1996, which essentially tries to, you know, formalize this notion that being accurate in terms of classification is different from being accurate in terms of assessment. Remember I used the example last time of if class C1's original probability is 0.666 and class C2's original probability is 0.3333, and you got 1 and 0 as the estimates, your estimates are way off, and yet you got the right answer. Okay, so it's one of those cases where it's objective test. If you tick the right answer without justification, you're not required to give a justification, and if you tick the right answer, you get, and if the answer is right, you get marks. Okay. Let me just see. What I'm going to start now, what am I doing? Is sort of go from where we are into filtering. You know, we've been doing NBC as text classification, and it turns out that you can think of, once you understand classification learning, you can also use it as a filtering approach. And the applications of filtering essentially are basically in the personalization sort of scenarios, which all of you probably already know. This is a personalization software where, you know, you're being told that since you bought these other things, you might be interested in this thing too. Since you bought these other things and other people like you have bought this kind of stuff, you must be interested in keeping up with Jones. And, you know, you should buy everything that Joneses have because you are like Joneses. Okay. So collaborative filtering ensures neighborhood morality of that type by saying, you know, people like you are buying this stuff, so how come you are such a dweeb, you're not buying it? Okay, that's a useful thing too. So in trying to recommend, you could do recommendation, you could do filtering, which is before you even show to people, you can decide what to put in the top 10 versus below top 10. Okay, and you could predict, you could sort of guess based on what you're writing, what you're likely to write next, what you're likely to be looking for. Okay, so the more you know about the way the user is interacting with the system, the more you can be helpful. Either of these two are predicting, could help in prefetching, for example. You know, how many of you know radar from MASH? We want a radar. All of us want a radar. Okay, and that poor guy, there's only one of them, but, you know, we want some assistant which completes our sentences and takes care of our problems even before we actually articulate them. Okay, that's what a great assistant is supposed to do. And, you know, I have all these great examples of in MASH, like, you know, this guy, before he completes the sentence, Radar already thought about it, and he has, okay, you know, I need to sign the form is ready even before he completed the request, And he says, I need a pen. The pen is ready too, because this guy knows what is required. And obviously, the guy made the user's life easier. And so why can't we have machine learning systems which do that? And in fact, there is a currently there is a DARPA-funded project called CM Radar, which is Carnegie Mellon's version of Radar, which tries to do this kind of thing in a computer application format. So there are two types of filtering approaches you could use in terms of technology. I mean, you know the users. We talked about the users right now. There are two types of actual techniques you can use. One is try to provide filtering, prediction, etc., based on the content that the user has seen till now. So those are called user profiling. Okay, so you bought these kinds of books, so you're likely to like these other kinds of books too. Now, to do that, you already know how to do that. Amazon, basically, for each book, it has described that book in terms of some features. Okay, you bought 5 books, and you looked at certain other books that you didn't buy. So they have a profile on you. They have training data on you about books you bought, books you didn't buy. They can train an NBC classifier, and they can start. Given a new book, they can decide whether or not you are likely to be interested in it, and you show it to you. So this basically content-based user profiling is a classic example of classification learning. So I just happen to have already solved it, so I don't have to solve it again. And the other thing that you have in web scenarios is, you not only you're not the only user, there are other users out there. And so you could start talking about how you are connected to other users as against what you have bought before. And if you start taking similarity between you and other users and use that to decide what to suggest to you, that's collaborative filtering. And it turns out that obviously they both have advantages. Content-based filtering is essentially a user profile. It depends mostly on what the user has bought. And so it requires that the user has bought enough things that you have some profile of them. Collaborative filtering, on the other hand, depends on how many other people have bought things similar to the things that you have bought. Because to decide the similarity between you and other users, so what do? They don't just look at your address. What they do is they look at your buying pattern. So in particular, just as you can have a term document matrix, you can have what? User item matrix. Term document user item matrix. And you can do all sorts of, for example, clustering examples. Like, remember the scalar clusters, etc., that you did on the term document? You could do that on the user item matrix. And they can decide, you can take user item to compute item-item correlations and see which items are most correlated. And so if you bought item 4, then you must be interested in item 7 and item 9 because, you know, everybody else who are buying item 4 are buying those things. It just comes out of, you know, the box. You know, this is like teaching without actually teaching, you know. You know the mathematician example where, you don't know mathematician, where he decides to show that he basically... We'll just do the mathematics example and we'll leave for today. So there's content-based and collaborative. Content-based we definitely completed. Collaborative, I sort of gave you an idea as to how it's going to be connected. It's going to be in terms of user item matrices. And we actually will talk about a specific method for collaborative filtering, which involves covariance analysis between users. It's a sort of like computing, a variation of computing correlation clusters, and then use that to decide which are your most close similar users. And once you pick your similar users, you use things like essentially k nearest neighbor kind of an idea and say that if your similar users bought those things, then you should also buy those things. We'll complete that. That should not be too hard. And what's more interesting is we can actually combine content-based and collaborative filtering. And that's actually quite interesting. It turns out that both of them have problems, but the problems are complementary rather than the same. Okay? And it turns out you can combine both those ideas to do better than any one of them. Okay? So the mathematician example essentially is this mathematician is sleeping one night, and then he wakes up and he finds that something in the kitchen is on fire, and he has a problem now, so he has to set off the fire. So he has an empty glass next to him, so he goes to the sink, fills the glass, pours the water on the fire and comes back and sleeps. 10 days later, there's another fire. This time he wakes up, he actually sees that there is a full glass next to him. So he empties the glass and says, now it's reduced to a problem already been solved. And goes back to sleep. Okay. So we'll talk about the rest of collaborative filtering next time.